I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. President Trump will announce his choice for the U.S. Supreme Court tonight. NPR will have live coverage at 8 o'clock. Here's some things we can count on. He or she will be conservative. The Federalist Society has signed off on them. He or she will serve well past middle age. Most justices retire in their 70s and 80s. And he or she will leave only when they decide the time is right, because the court is a lifetime appointment. What if it wasn't? Can an argument be made for Supreme Court term limits? It's one of the questions we're going to consider about the way the court works as we await the president's announcement. So give it some thought with us. Is there an advantage or a disadvantage to a term-limited high court? But what if presidents tried harder to appoint lawyers with more varied experience, not so many law professors and academics? How about that idea? 651-227-6000. On reforming the U.S. Supreme Court and some conversation this morning about who may end up on the court, 800-242-2828, and you can reach me on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Kimberly Atkins is with us. She's the chief Washington reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald, and she's with us today from D.C. Kimberly, I know you are super busy. Thanks so much for the time. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Ilya Shapiro is with us. He's a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, and he is with us today from Washington. Ilya, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good to be on.
I want to ask you both about this thing that I was talking about with Ken Rudin, which is the politics of the nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court seem to be, I guess, fiercer among Republicans than they do among Democrats. Ilya, do you agree with that, and is there a reason for it if it's true?
I think so, and I think that's because, at least in modern times, the last few decades, the pick for the Republicans is more ideological, and there's the social conservatives involved, the business community, the establishment. Everyone kind of has their favorite, wants to avoid a nominee who will move left over time, or who will be a, quote, squishy moderate like Kennedy, or maybe too minimalist like Roberts on the Obamacare case, or what have you. All of these different concerns that are being fought out on substantive legal points and kind of other ideological interests. Among the Democrats, I think it's more identity politics, making sure you have the right ethnic and gender balance, and as long as you have someone with enough experience and the Democratic president vouches for them, I think that's generally enough. So it's just the way that the various coalitions within the parties, I think, work politically and how that's reflected when you're talking about Supreme Court justices.
Kimberly, I think that's really interesting. So there's a symbolism more for Democrats, and there is hardcore issue kind of politics for Republicans. Do you buy this?
I think so. I think that Ilya's on the is correct in that sense. But look at history. I think that's one reason why we've seen that happen in more recent histories. The Democratic appointed Supreme Court justices have by and large voted in the way that Democratic members of the Senate would expect them to. Uh-huh. It's the Republican appointees that we have seen have some surprises. Everyone from Justices Sandra Day O'Connor, David Souter, Anthony Kennedy, John Paul Stevens. These are all folks who frequently would vote with the more liberal justices on the court. And so after a few decades of that, Republicans have really taken a different stance and is really looking for somebody to be a solid conservative voice for decades to come in the way, just the way that the Democratic nominees have. I think as a result, you have seen less of an urgency among Democratic lawmakers on the issue of the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
Republicans
that's right.
were all about the Supreme Court in 2016, and the Democrats weren't so much. You didn't even really see the groundswell of support for Merrick Garland at the time that his nomination stalled that you would have expected. So I think that has sort of seeped in. I think Democrats now are realizing that they should have put more time into it.
You just used the phrase decades to come, and that's one of the things that I want to talk about today. Why is it that Supreme Court justices get a lifetime term once they're on the court? Does it say that they shall serve a lifetime term anywhere in our documents?
Is that for me?
Yeah.
There's no limit. There is no constitutional limit for Supreme Court justices, and that's why once they get that appointment, they are there as long as they want to be.
And Ilya, could a case be made, as has been made in some of the reading that I was doing over the weekend, that lifetime is too long. You have justices who are hanging on well into their 80s. What's wrong with bringing some new thinking and fresh, you know, fresh intellect to the court? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, as a theoretical matter, if you were designing the system afresh, you'd probably think about those sorts of things. The biggest concern is that if you have justices appointed who are looking for their next job, then they might, especially towards the end of their term, start currying favor with certain business groups, or if they want to become a private sector arbitrator or something like that. But at the same time, if you only have one, say, 18-year term, which is what's been proposed, and presumably you have people later in life being nominated who wouldn't really be going back into the private sector or looking for their next job. The problem with all of this, and I do agree that I think for various reasons it might be a good idea to have a term limit, is I think it would require a constitutional amendment. Curiously, it would not require a constitutional amendment to expand or shrink the size of the court, the number of the justices, but given what the Constitution says about holding their office during a good performance or basically short of impeachment, to reduce or to impose term limits, or even to say, okay, you remain a federal judge for life, but you'll just rotate down to the lower courts, I think that would be difficult, and that's why it's kind of been a political non-starter.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't realize that it would take an amendment. You think that, or it's pretty clear from the way it's spelled out in the Constitution?
The way it says in the Constitution is that they federal judges hold their office during good behavior. Now,
okay.
There have been some theories proposed that, as I said, holding office might mean, okay, you keep your pension, you keep your salary, you're still a life tenured judge, but you rotate off the Supreme Court and serve in the lower courts, and Congress could pass a statute to that effect. I don't know if a particular justice who is due to rotate off, quote unquote, would challenge that in court, but it's a dubious legal theory. And so while I agree that there could be some healthy developments to have these kind of term limits, although if you look back the last 30 years, say, the mix of Republican to Democratic appointees probably wouldn't be that different given the natural rotation in the White House, but still. Very difficult, and so that's why you have a lot of people talking about expanding the court, and not just court packing by Democrats because they feel out of power, but if you could solve the transition problem, presumably if you have, say, 19 justices on the court, then any one seat, the battle over any one seat, becomes less fraught than one over nine. But again, the problem is, how do you get from 9 to 19? Is it every 2 years? Is it start appointments, you know, from 10 years from now when nobody knows who will be president? Those are the kind of issues that academics talk about.
Kimberly, I was reading something that Bob Bauer, who was President Obama's counsel for a time, was writing about this, and he's, as Ilya suggested, he's arguing for these 18-year term limits, and he says it would diffuse a lot of the political drama that surrounds these selections and confirmations. And he talks about modesty, so here's how he puts it. This cap on terms could also nudge the court toward a greater posture of humility. Justices serving for only a defined term, their ranks regularly refreshed, might have a more reliably modest sense of their mission. Do they have an outsized sense of their mission, Kimberly?
That's interesting. I mean, I think they're certainly aware of their mission. They're certainly aware of their role on the court and in history, and certainly the Chief Justice is. I don't know if these proposals would include rotating out the Chief Justice as well. And so I think that they are aware of it. I think in some sense it could theoretically take some of the politics out if there is a term limit. Conversely, it might put more politics in. If we know every year a president's going to have X amount of Supreme Court nominees to put in place, you're going to have a lot of jockeying over that very early in the process. And remember, the Supreme Court justice appointment was meant to be the court is supposed to be apolitical. It's supposed to be separated from the political apparatus of the government. And this would be really putting it squarely within that apparatus in terms of that jockeying. And there were rules rules. Remember, there were rules in place in the Senate for the purpose of doing things like encouraging of the Senate to come together to back a candidate and encouraging presidents to appoint consensus building candidates to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's why we used to require that 60 members of the Senate vote to approve a justice. That was particularly the reason was to take the politics out of it. But we've seen that go away, and now people are looking for other solutions. I just think it's a case of be careful what you wish for, because it can have a lot of unintended consequences.
Call here from Mike in St. Paul. Hey, Mike, hi.
Hi. Yeah, you know, it's interesting you're talking about trying to keep politics out of the court. Unfortunately, some of the issues that are before the court and the issues that come before Congress, they're not political issues. They're issues that require problem solvers. So healthcare just requires problem solvers. Dr. Michael Debakey was on NPR several years ago, and he said he could fix healthcare with a group of smart people or people who had varied perspectives. We unfortunately put these issues into a political cauldron, and we don't get any resolution. We've seen it for years. Congress can't even fix the most basic things in many cases.
So, Mike,
so getting back to the court.
The court
is we're putting in people who are partisan, who there's a litmus test, even though they say there isn't. And so they have a certain view. So we're baking those people in for 10, 20 years, and yet they're not problem solvers. They come from a partisan viewpoint.
Okay, so I think that's
the get a solution.
And this is a good point here, Mike. Which, and to you, Ilya, I heard somebody call last week and talk about whether the court is political or partisan and whether there's a difference. How would you describe it?
Well, the court's not a self-starting institution. It doesn't just go and reach out and grab whatever issues it wants to rule on. Cases are brought before it. And so it's a reactive institution in that sense. What's developed over decades, this is not an overnight thing or even, you know, a very recent phenomenon, is that you have divergent theories of constitutional and statutory interpretation, which have come to map on to party preferences. That is, originalists and textualists tend to be Republican, and those who look at the purpose of the law and kind of a constitution that evolves with the times tend to be Democrats. And at the same time, the political parties themselves have sorted ideologically. You no longer have conservative Democrats or liberal Republicans. And so not only do you call judges and justices conservative and liberal, which is bad enough, but people understandably start referring to them as Republicans and Democrats. That's not a good thing. That's not a healthy thing for our civic politics. But there's not much that you can do given this dynamics. And as I said, it's a decades-long change. I date it back to the 30s and 40s when sort of theories of constitutional interpretation, the court itself, began taking its jurisprudence away from kind of the basic text of the Constitution. And we can't put the genie back in the bottle, certainly not overnight. And I don't blame the politicians, given the very important interests at stake, for acting as they do. And ultimately, the people have to judge which party is going to present the best judges or apply the best theories. But it's not an easy question, and I have to differ with the caller. It's not simply a matter of figuring out how to do it. We have clashes of values at stake. It's not simply a matter of crunching the numbers correctly.
Yeah, Kimberly, though, I hear what our caller was saying, too, though, about these are political issues that end up in front of the court, and they really never get fully resolved. I guess they never coalesce public opinion. We're as divided over Obamacare as we ever have been, you know, no matter what the court decided on that in a pretty difficult decision.
Yeah, well, I mean, remember that it's not the job of the court to solve these questions. The job of the court was not to make a decision on Obamacare. Chief Justice John Roberts, in his opinion, was crystal clear about that. The job of the justices of the Supreme Court is to decide an unsettled issue of law based on the Constitution and or the laws that are passed by Congress as written, or both. So that is their choice. Now, of course, yes, they have different ways of approaching it, which Ilya pointed out very clearly, depending on their theory of constitutional construction or statutory interpretation. But in the end, that's what they're doing. They're deciding laws. They're not here to say, is Obamacare right or wrong, or things like that. Now, that being said, of course, there are a lot of issues that these determinations of right and wrong come into play. I think a great example is the Obergefell decision on same-sex marriage, where Justice Anthony Kennedy talked extensively about the dignity of same-sex couples and their families, or in other cases that tested religious freedom, talking about closely held religious beliefs of individuals and how that needs to be protected. That comes into play. But at the end of the day, they're making legal determinations, not political ones.
Kimberly Atkins is with us, if you've tuned in, as we await the announcement tonight by President Trump of his Supreme Court nominee. She's a Washington reporter for the Boston Herald and a columnist, and we often talk with her about the U.S. Supreme Court. Ilya Shapiro is with us. He's a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute. And we're also considering some suggested reforms for the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, realizing that many of these are probably not going to come to pass, but there's a lot of debate and complaint about the U.S. Supreme Court, depending on what side you're on. So we thought we would consider some of these suggestions. 651-227-6000 on whether you believe presidents should try harder to appoint people to the court with more varied experience. I want to ask Ilya and Kimberly about this as well. Not so many law professors and academics. Is there value to that? Do you have other reforms that you'd like to suggest in the discussion? 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. To the phones to Gary in St. Paul. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Hey.
Yes, my comment is we need to get rid of the system that is in our judicial system. It's too corrupt, and it's all political. We have to give the voting back to the people, and the people should be making these decisions on which judges get elected into the office, not the president.
Okay.
Because it's all politics that way.
So, Ilya, I think Gary is suggesting that the American voters would vote on these nominations. What do you think?
Well, that obviously would take a constitutional amendment as well, but I'm hesitant about endorsing elections for judges. I like the federal system where you have input from both the executive branch and the Senate and the legislative branch to confirm someone to the judicial branch. I don't like the systems in some states where they have certain boards that make that choice, because that tends to get captured by either trial lawyers or a particular industry in the state or something like that. And elections really make judges more like legislators. And so if they make an unpopular ruling, they can get voted out. We've seen that both from the left and the right in the last decades. And I don't think that's a healthy thing for impartial judges, who often have to check majority impulses that violate individual rights. So, fundamentally, the problem isn't so much the methods by which we're selecting it. It's this political dynamic that we're in. And when you have so many key decisions being taken in Washington, especially by this court,
right,
the debates are going to be fraught. That's understandable. Really, what's needed is to diffuse some of these decisions that are being made, whether it's over health care or guns or so many different things that are fraught. I think we're supposed to have federalism, and we don't need a one-size-fits-all regulatory scheme that, let California be California and Texas be Texas and Minnesota be Minnesota and the localities as well. As much as you can push down decision-making and power, the less clashes and the less culture wars there's going to be nationwide.
In some ways, I think, Kimberly, that also argues for one of the other things I was thinking about, is why don't they bring more people to these nominee lists from a variety of experience? I mean, you know, I was at one point when Elena Kagan was up for confirmation, I think every member of the Supreme Court had come from Harvard or Yale. How come nobody from the JAG Corps of the military seems to end up? How about lawyers who argue death penalty case? You know, people who would bring a life experience that's going to be pretty different from their colleagues on the court. I think it'd be valuable. Why doesn't that happen?
Yeah, or people who have experience running businesses or,
right.
or other things.
Yeah.
That has been a continuous discussion over Supreme Court justices, I think up until now, when you have this very, you know, list of very conservative folks who come mostly from the judicial field. But that is something that has been a consideration by previous presidents. If you remember, Sandra Day O'Connor was a politician. She
That's
held
right.
office
yeah.
Before going to the U.S. Supreme Court. You would see that in the past over history. That was the case. Interestingly enough, a Supreme Court justice doesn't even have to be a lawyer. They just have to be nominated and confirmed by the Senate.
I knew that, but they always are lawyers, aren't
they? Always are, and yeah. I think it's a good idea for them to be. Let me be clear.
Okay.
But you could definitely pull from different places than Ivy League graduates from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which seems to be the main pipeline to the high court. You can also pull geographically from different places.
Exactly.
Before Neil Gorsuch was appointed, all of the justices were largely from one coast or another, with the exception of the chief justice, who was born in Buffalo and grew up in Indiana. It was an entirely coastal court.
Gorsuch was Colorado, wasn't he?
Yes, Gorsuch is from
yeah.
Colorado, and you're seeing some of the nominees, the shortlisters now, who are from places like Michigan and Pennsylvania. There is an idea to change that, but I think different backgrounds is something that is always talked about, but somehow it never ends up being the final nominee.
Call here from John in St. Paul. Hey, John, thanks for waiting.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Always appreciate your shows. Always appreciate the invigorating conversation. It may have been said already, but my understanding is that the function of the Supreme Court is to interpret the Constitution. That's its mandate. And there's no way that the founding fathers could have interpreted the Internet or Bitcoin and things that have evolved in our society and culture. So I think there's an argument to be made for term limits on the Supreme Court for that very reason, that you always bring different and newer judges in there to interpret and reinterpret the Constitution in light of these things. But when I think about the resiliency of that document, it's just astonishing. And I think that it should be granted the respect that it generally deserves. And potential limits on the Supreme Court is the reason I just gave, is also the reason I think there should be term limits on Congress to keep bringing in new ideas and different ideas that can be more aligned with what's going on in society. So I don't think there was a question there, but I'll take...
No, but you've given me some places to go, and I want to go to Ilya since he's our senior fellow in constitutional studies. What do you think of John's argument? And Ilya, I'll add, he brings up some really good points about the complexity and the contemporary quality to some of these issues that are ending up before the court. How well-versed are the justices? And, you know, if an issue comes up around Bitcoin or some of that, what would you say?
Well, the complexity arises in many circumstances. You have lay juries sitting in judgment about very complicated antitrust lawsuits, for example.
Yeah, that's true.
And if you had term limits, you know, none of this necessarily militates towards term limits one way or another. If you had term limits, presumably you'd start having people who are 60 appointed rather than looking at people who are in their late 40s, early 50s. So you don't necessarily bring new blood and understanding the latest apps or what have you. But then you also have to understand that there are certain things that, yes, might introduce complexity just in terms of understanding how it works in the real world without necessarily changing how the law applies. So the framers obviously did not conceive of airplane travel, let alone trains or steamships, and yet the Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce, which was written in 1787 and ratified 2 years later from the original Constitution, you can apply that to modern commerce, whether it's telecommunications and the Internet or travel interstate by whatever the latest transportation method is. So there are certain things that are easier than one thinks, and there's others that are more difficult, as the court grappled with this term with cell site location data as your phone is constantly pinging off these towers,
right.
And do the police need a warrant for that? And the evolving nature of how you apply the Fourth Amendment's protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, what does that mean in the digital age? I don't think necessarily you need, you know, younger people or different people, but it does, you know, the judges are not robots. Even if you have a very well-defined legal theory, you still have to apply it. You still have to apply that, you know, whatever your interpretation is to the changing facts that might be on the ground. But in bringing it back to the original question that you asked, Kim, varied backgrounds, I think, would be useful. Trump's original list of 11 and then 20 had state court judges from all across the country.
Wow.
There was nobody from the coast,
huh.
And different schools, as you were saying, all this sort of thing. So that's at least variety of geographical and state courts, not just federal courts. But it seems like even law professors, one of the shortlisters now, Amy Coney Barrett, was a law professor for most of her career until just less than a year ago being appointed to the federal courts. I think it would be great to consider more professors, politicians. We haven't had a sitting senator or governor appointed, I think, in over something like 60 years. Mike Lee, of course, was on the list.
Yeah, and then was dropped off pretty fast. Why?
Yeah. Apparently, I'm guessing because he was sort of a never-Trumper and called for Trump to withdraw after the Access Hollywood video and all of that sort of thing. So it's just politics. But yeah, I would like to see people who, whether public defenders, prosecutors, politicians, or what have you. The issue is, of course, eventually people who are stellar in those kinds of jobs tend to make it into the judiciary, state or federal. But you do want to see what a broader range of background, at least in their earlier careers.
A good question here from Paul in St. Cloud, who called to ask, should decisions that were decided 40 to 50 years ago really be considered sacred? For example, Plessy v. Ferguson was decided in the 1890s and didn't get overturned until the 1960s. That seems like an excessive reliance on precedent. And he's saying, not saying Roe v. Wade should be overturned. So, Kimberly, we're hearing a lot. We're hearing Susan Collins talk about precedent and a lot of discussion around precedent. What could you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea, the principle of stare decisis is the way to ensure that we get a consistent and stable set of rules and laws that judges, not just on the high court, but in courts across the country, can turn to and look at and have some certainty in the legal rulings. If precedent keeps getting, reversed very easily, that creates a lot of instability and uncertainty in the legal world. So it has that component to it. At the same time, sometimes you get bad decisions, like Plessy, and it's up to the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court to say, you know, the court got it wrong then, and we're getting it right now. Now, stare decisis is not, written in stone. We do see decisions overturned. Just this past term, we saw some rulings overturned. But it is an important principle. I don't think it should go by the wayside. But you have decisions, controversial ones like Roe v. Wade, where you have justices on both sides of the aisle and experts of all ideologies who point to a lot of faults with that decision and the way that it came down. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that the effect of it was probably, to push, that states probably would have figured it out themselves and would have ended the necessity for a Supreme Court decision had the court not ruled on it so soon. So that's just one of the, no judicial system is perfect. But I think that we should be, I think when you come to a time where there is a lot of controversy, there is a lot of division, you have a lot of people looking at the rules and the system that we have and saying, you know what, this needs to be changed and that needs to be changed. We need to elect judges or we need to get rid of stare decisis. And I think it's a big danger of trying to change big rules in order to affect a result that you want in the immediate time without really looking at how that might impact other things.
Okay.
I think if you look at the history, the system has held up pretty well for hundreds of years.
Yeah, I want to follow up here, Ilya, with a tweet that asks a question about this. A listener says, can your guests explain how a case like Roe v. Wade could be overturned? Because the Supreme Court is the highest court. My impression was that once they ruled on an issue, their decision was permanent because no other court can overturn them. is it the case of a new law that's coming up to be decided? Is that how it works?
Well, right. The court just can't say, oh, yeah, we were wrong 40 years ago or 50 years ago or whatever, we overturn it. There has to be some sort of challenge, and these are generally legal strategies brought by advocates on a particular political issue. And they design this so that they're quickly ruled against in the lower courts because they're bound by that Supreme Court opinion. And then they petition the Supreme Court to hear the case and hear arguments for overturning that old law. That's what just happened this past term in two cases, one involving public sector unions charging fees to non-members. And that was overturning a 40-year-old precedent. The court said that that was no longer justifiable under the First Amendment. And state taxation of internet companies, which sold products into their state but did not have a physical presence. The court allowed that, overturning a 25-year-old precedent. So there's a certain standard that gets about stare decisis that gets looked at. How workable is the old rule? Are there modern developments like the internet, e-commerce, or what have you that make the old rule unworkable? How much do people rely, not simply in terms of a funding source to the unions, as came up in the Janus case, but in terms of how they organize their business or their daily lives based on these certain rules that are in place that would disrupt things unduly to get that old error right now. Was the reasoning, how persuasive does it remain? Do we now just see that they reasoning? So all of these kind of factors that judges look at, it's not a set and fast rule about how long a precedent is in force or whether it gets stronger or weaker over time. But it would take, in the abortion context, I think it would take a state that passed a law that restricted abortion and someone challenged it, or someone challenging an existing state law that allows abortion, somehow challenging that, and requiring the courts to decide that on a federal issue. Because if the state courts end up deciding that based on state constitutional law, say, the Supreme Court would have no say. But finally, the point, which is, I guess, everybody is thinking about Roe v. Wade, if John Roberts, as is likely to become the median vote, I doubt he would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade or Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which is the actual standard on these sorts of things, although he would allow, I think, he would vote to allow more and more restrictions without having to overturn the precedent altogether.
Ilya, forgive me, I have to run. Ilya Kimberly, thank you so much for the time and the insight and the benefit of your experience. Good to have
it. Thank
you. My pleasure.
I'll leave you both with this from Catherine on Twitter. She says, which SCOTUS decisions do you think were adversely affected by judges coming from Harvard, Yale, law, academia, and the coast? I want justices who know the law and Constitution phenomenally well and who write cogent opinions. That's not Bezos or Gates or Trump.